This is the CSIS Global Health Interview Series at www.smartglobalhealth.org.
Good morning. My name is Catherine Bliss, and I direct the Project on Global Water Policy at CSIS. I am joined here today by Charles Fishman, author of the recently released book, The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. A journalist, Charles has covered business issues for The Washington Post, Fast Company, and other groups, and wrote The Walmart Effect, which was a New York Times bestseller. He is here today to talk about The Big Thirst and to share his perspective on global water challenges and solutions. Charles, thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, as a reporter, you've been covering business for a long time. You've covered Wall Street and Walmart, and now you've written a book about water, which many people view as free or priceless or a gift from the heavens rather than something to be bought and sold. So what drew you to investigate water as both a resource and a commodity?
Well, actually, my experience as a business journalist drew me first to water. I stumbled into the business of bottled water. I'm old enough that when I was a child and a teenager, nobody walked around with bottled water. Bottled water was not a business. And now, as an adult, my kids are very accustomed to having bottles of water whenever they want, the commercial product, as well as the refillable ones. And so a couple of years ago, I actually plunged in to try and understand where the business of bottled water had come from. Bottled water is literally a business for which there is no real need on a regular basis in the United States. It's a pure indulgence now. Wine is a business for which there's no real need. We can make it through the day without wine. There are plenty of things that we enjoy but don't absolutely need. But in fact, bottled water is a little bit unique because we don't have wine on tap in our homes, for instance, and we all have easily accessible water. And so I wanted to ask the question, where did the business of bottled water come from? Why do we find bottled water appealing as consumers? And I ended up going all the way to Fiji to visit the Fiji water plant. And I went to Poland Spring, Maine to visit the Poland Spring, the actual spring. And I went to San Pellegrino. And the response to the story about bottled water was so dramatic. People were simply curious. I got hundreds of emails from people that it became very clear that people really are curious about water in general. And so for me, the door into trying to ask and answer questions about water literally came through bottled water. And I think bottled water is an interesting little case study of a lot of attitudes about water. But in fact, it's a very small issue compared to the much larger questions of how we manage our water infrastructure, our pipes and our pumps and our sources of water in a place like the United States and the developed world, and the struggle, which we can't manage to seem to become successful at in simply providing clean, safe water to people in developing countries around the world. People have been working on water issues for decades, and yet there are still one in six people in the world doesn't have clean water every day. And so bottled water drew me to the issue, but the much larger, more interesting questions are what inspired me to write a book.
So the book opens with a section that provides a number of fairly unusual facts, different facts, about water to help the reader put his or her water use into broader perspective. Can you share three things about water that will surprise people who read your book?
Sure. The book actually opens with the launching of the space shuttle. The space shuttle requires water to get off the launch pad, and I think anybody who's ever watched a space shuttle launch on TV has seen this incredible cascade, literally a waterfall of water flooding the launch pad as the space shuttle takes off. And you would naturally think that the water has something to do with the fire and thrust of the rockets, but it actually has nothing to do with that. The space shuttle is so loud that the noise from the rockets would bounce off the concrete and steel launch pad and ricochet back up. And the noise is so powerful that the sound waves would tear the rocket apart before it actually cleared the launch tower without the water. What the water does is act as a sound barrier, as a sound cushion. It absorbs the water and allows the space shuttle to be launched safely. I just thought that was incredible when I stumbled into it. our microwave ovens only work because of water. The microwaves in the microwave oven don't actually cook the food. They spin the water molecules. They heat the water molecules up, and it's the heated water molecules that cook the rest of your food. That's why microwave pizza doesn't turn out that well. And, you know, I asked the most basic question, which I was sort of embarrassed not to know the answer to already, which was, where did the water on Earth, the water we rely on, come from? And it turns out that there's no water being made or destroyed on Earth in the big picture. All the water we have is all the water we've ever had, and it was all delivered here from outer space about the time the planet was formed, a little after, most people think, most scientists think. And all that water was formed out in the Milky Way. And so literally your saliva came from the Milky Way. And I think when you sort of have that perspective on water, it helps you both appreciate it and understand that water is completely renewable. We have all the water we've ever had, but also it's the only water we're ever going to have. And so it both gives you some respect for water's resilience, but also some responsibility for taking care of the water that's available to us, because it's the water that has made the planet what it is.
As the book goes along, it's interesting that you chose to focus an entire chapter on India, with the title, Where Water is Worshipped but Gets No Respect. So I'm curious if you could say a little bit about what was compelling to you about India's water challenges in particular, and to say a little bit about what the title means.
Okay. Let's start with the title. The rivers in India, the major rivers, the Ganges, the Yamuna, are literally regarded as goddesses. And I think that's a little hard for Westerners to understand, and I don't claim to actually understand it, but they are literally worshipped as part of Indian practice. And yet, the Indian rivers contain actually among the dirtiest water anywhere on Earth. The Yamuna, which flows through Delhi and is the main tributary, provides about half the flow of the Ganges. I actually went out on the Yamuna River in a little skiff that was pulled by a man from Delhi. And the surface of the Yamuna looks kind of like root beer. It's deep brown, and it's speckled with tiny little bubbles as if it was carbonated. The Yamuna is so dirty that it produces methane, and the methane bubbles up out of the river. I was actually warned by a State Department official in India not to bring anything that could cause a spark out on the river. How dirty is it? It is so dirty that the river flowing through Delhi is so dirty that U.S. sewage treatment plants would not be permitted to accept the water. It is too dirty for our wastewater treatment plants. The EPA standard for safe human contact of water, this isn't drinking, but just allowing it to touch your skin, is 50 E. coli bacteria in 4 ounces of water, 50 E. coli in half a cup. The Yamuna has 10 million E. coli in half a cup. So it is an utterly, utterly polluted, completely, thoroughly polluted river, and yet it's worshipped as a goddess. And so in some ways, that encapsulates the complicated attitude about water in India. In the developed world, in the U.S., we also have complicated attitudes about water. We're willing to spend for a single bottle of Evian or Fiji water, $1.50 for a half liter. That's 2,000 times the price of that water at home. So that's a complicated attitude, too. We scream about our water bills, and yet we're willing to pay 2,000 times the cost of our home water for productized water. In India, the reason I went to India, I spent almost a month touring, traveling in India, and talking to people just about water in India. To me, India is a fascinating place because India has more than enough water, and yet it has what have proven to be really complicated and intractable water problems. And it turns out that India's water problems are rarely about water. They're about how water is managed, the politics around water, the economics around water. And so for me, it was a great place to look at what happens when you have enough water but don't manage it well, because that's one of the things that could well happen in the United States. And in little pockets all over the world, they have that same kind of problem. And so India has enough water. They even have enough money to solve water problems. They just have political, economic, and attitude problems in how to solve those water issues, how to resolve them. And so for me, it was just a great place to try and see what that looks like. And it's often easier to understand someone else's problems than your own.
So, you know, if you go to a water conference or if you are asked to give a talk on water, you know, you might be asked to talk about the global water crisis. There are a lot of titles out there about the global water crisis, you know, a lot of discussion about that. But you have argued that, in fact, there's not necessarily one global water crisis, but that there are different ways to think about that and that we should be looking more at the local level. Could you explain a little bit about that argument?
Yes, I think, in fact, the water world composed of, you know, businesses paying attention to water, NGOs paying attention to water, governments paying attention to water, charitable organizations paying attention to water, it's very common to refer to the global water crisis with tremendous urgency, as if there were sort of a sisterhood or brotherhood of crises. There's the global energy crisis and the global economic crisis and the global environmental crisis and the global health crisis, and there's the global water crisis. And I think two things. First, I think that's wrong. There is no global water crisis. Many places have serious water issues. 5,000 children a day die just in India. That's the equivalent of 10 elementary schools of U.S. children dying every single day just because of water issues. There's no more serious problem than that. But there's no relationship between children dying from tainted water in India and Atlanta almost running out of water because of drought and poor management. That is, there's no connection between the actual events. There are all kinds of things that places can learn from each other. Almost all water problems are local. They are local to the watershed or to the city or to the community, and they need to be tackled at a local level. The people in Orlando who have lots of water really can't help the people in Atlanta solve their drought problems. The people in Atlanta have to tackle their own water problems. So water problems in another place may be devastating, but if you don't live in that place, there's not that much you can do except express sympathy. The second reason I think the phrase the global water crisis is a mistake, in addition to sort of lifting responsibility from local communities to tackle their own issues, if you think it's a global crisis, you may wait for some organization to come help you tackle it, is that referring to something as a global crisis makes it seem like there's nothing ordinary people can do. I can't really fix the global economic crisis. I can change my commuting habits or my how we use electricity at home, but that can instantly be undone by the power plants being built in China or India. But in fact, water issues are well within the ability of ordinary people to actually have an impact, partly because they're right in their community and partly because your own water habits really do matter. And so I think it's important to say there are a whole set of issues around water, but all water issues are local. The consequences of those issues may not be local, but they need to be dealt with and grappled with at the local level, and no one cares more about your water than you. And so I think it's misleading, and I think it also does a disservice to getting the problem solved.
So many of the stories and reports that one can read about global water challenges start off by citing negative statistics regarding access to water supply, and they paint a pretty grim picture of future water scarcity scenarios as well. But in your book, you seem pretty optimistic that there are technical and management innovations out there that will enable the world to make progress in addressing water problems, both managing water at the local level and perhaps grappling with these issues as a global society and talking and thinking about water in different ways. Why are you optimistic, and what are some of the trends and solutions that give you cause for hope?
So two things that seemed really obvious to me after 3 years of visiting countries and communities and just listening to people talk about water and watching what they're doing. Two things were quite obvious. One is there is a tremendous blossoming of innovation around water all around the world at the most basic level in villages in India and Africa, where people struggle to get clean water every day and live on a dollar a day. There's innovation happening there. And the most advanced companies in the world, places like IBM and GE and Intel and Coca-Cola, they are thinking about water. They are developing new ideas and approaches to managing water, as well as new kinds of water technology. Everywhere you look, there's a kind of a bubbling up of new ideas about water. And it's been an arena that the sort of era of innovation of the last 10 or 20 years has really bypassed. So that gave me great cause for optimism. And connected directly to that is that almost everywhere I visited where people were having serious water problems, ordinary people, whether in the context of their community or in the context of the company they work in, were grabbing hold of their own water problems and trying to solve them. People have stopped waiting. Again, whether they live in a poor neighborhood in Delhi or run a huge, you know, company in suburban Adelaide in Australia, they have decided not to wait for someone else to come solve their water problems and tried to begin tackling them themselves. So those two things, innovation and a dawning consciousness that A, no one's going to solve our problem for us, and B, the problem is solvable, give me a little sense of hope. We all need water every day, so you can't ignore the problem. What I saw, the final piece is, if you want to tackle climate change, if you want to tackle dependence on fossil fuel, you have to put in place incredible global systems. It would really be nice to have some dramatic technological breakthrough that would allow us to generate electricity in this country without fossil fuels or nuclear power. Those things require remaking the industrialized economy of the world every minute of every day. So those problems aren't going to be solved by a week from Friday or a year from a week from Friday. Water problems are almost all bundled up with treating water more respectfully and thoughtfully and carefully in the environment, which is where it all comes from. Water doesn't actually come from the tap. It comes from a watershed somewhere. And managing the water we have more smartly, more thoughtfully, more creatively. Most water problems, I wouldn't say no water problems, but almost no water problems require any kind of dramatic technological breakthrough. We have the technology we need in hand to clean water and provide it to people who need it. In most places, we even have the money we need. We just don't deploy that money correctly. And so that may be a false optimism or a Pollyanna-ish optimism that it's easier to fix the human element than it is to have a technological breakthrough. But it's nice to see an arena where the problems can be dealt with at the local level and solved. If in fact Atlanta solves its water problem, San Francisco can't undo that solution. Once you've solved your own water problem, if you're paying attention, no one else can undo the solution. And that we don't need some dramatic technological breakthrough. We don't need Lawrence Livermore Labs to come through with something that will change the world of water in order to solve those problems. So that means they're amenable to solution, and we can be the people to do it. We don't have to wait for anybody else.
Well, Charles, thank you for taking the time to be here today. Again, I have been speaking with Charles Fishman, author of the recently released book, The Big Thirst, which covers the secret life and turbulent future of water. To hear more interviews with water experts and analysis of global water policy dilemmas, please visit the Project on Global Water Policy website at http://water.csis.org.
Thank you very much.